This is the Old Republic podcast.
Spoiler warning for the Knights of the Old Republic series, Star Wars, the Old Republic, and all other media.
This is where the fun begins.
Let's remind the Jedi what happens when the weak seek to match metal with the Dark Lords of the Sith.
Sir, from the surviving officer's reports, Lord Revan has gone down with the ship.
He's still alive.
Well, hello everyone. We hope you had a great 4th of July, and if you're Canadian, July the 2nd, I think. And if you're elsewhere in the world, I hope you're just having a good summer. But today we are coming for yet another cherished The Hero's Journey podcast memory, their pilot episode.
Yeah, that's right. We've been riffing on the Hero's Journey podcast now. We did the prequel trilogy. We covered The Phantom Menace. We covered Attack of the Clones. We covered Revenge of the Sith. So obviously, next up, we're going to the original trilogy. So we're going back in time to go ahead in the story. But this one's going to be, I don't know, on one hand, that's going to be very easy, I think, maybe, because this is like the most classic of Hero's Journey tales. But on the other hand, I think it's going to be hard and interesting to, you know, talk about it and have fun with it and make it entertaining. I don't know. I'm very interested to see how this one goes, Cassia.
Yeah, it's kind of like the example of the hero's journey. Sometimes, like, creative writing teachers also throw in, like, the Lord of the Rings, you know, or some other stories, but it seems like this is, like, the example, you know, and just reference like so much when it comes to like the hero's journey monomyth idea.
Yeah, exactly. Anytime you see anything or read anything about the monomyth or talking to someone about it, they're gonna be like, you know, and then this step, just like Luke Skywalker did X in Star Wars, because everyone knows the story and it's a very tried and true hero's journey. Obviously, you know, Lucas was a big kind of student of Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey, and definitely got applied to this story here. So yeah, it makes sense in a lot of ways that people would reference this material, when trying to explain or convey some bit of the hero's journey to people who maybe aren't as familiar with it or are trying to learn more about it. This is a great place to start.
And some people are like, oh, it was Jaws. Some people are like, oh, it was Star Wars, A New Hope. That was like the first blockbuster. But it inspired so many people. It inspired me, and I'm guessing it inspired you, you know. But mm-hmm. I guess, do you have, like, any cool background deets on the film, like box office or awards info?
Yeah, let's go through a couple of that. I was doing some research today, and I'm like, hey, man, you know, Star Wars, Episode 4, A New Hope, every, you know, it's been done in 1,000 different ways. What else can we bring to the table? So I said, I'm just going to do, like, the basics here. There's one little kind of fun tidbit that I found that I think maybe I knew, but had kind of forgotten about. So I want to throw that out there, too. But this was released in 1977, written and directed, as we know, by George Lucas, and it made a lot of money. $775 million, roughly, between the two releases, right? We had the release in 1977, and then we had these special editions that came out in 1997 that featured all the fun extra bits there. You had extra Jabba the Hutt, you had extra X-Wing shots, and all sorts of stuff that people loved or hated, depending on who you asked. But $775 million, pretty good, pretty good. You mentioned Jaws as being kind of the first blockbuster. That's true. Then Star Wars came out and topped it, and then was topped just shortly after by E.T. So Spielberg and Lucas were really going back and forth for box office supremacy. But you can't really put Star Wars down when it comes to that, because I think it stayed in theaters for like every year for like 5 straight years is pretty pretty crazy to think about. And then Star Wars became Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope in 1981. So I think that is pretty interesting. This was nominated and won 6 Academy Awards, plus a Special Achievement Award for Ben Burtt for sound effects, so that's pretty good. It also won Best Score for John Williams, Best Visual Effects, Best Editing, Best Sound, Best Costume Design, and Best Art Direction Set Decoration. It lost Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Supporting Actor for good old Obi-Wan Kenobi. Alec Guinness lost the Best Supporting Actor there, but... I don't know. That's a pretty good showing. 6 Academy Awards, because on one hand, obviously Star Wars changed the world in terms of movie making, what could be accomplished both visually on the screen and what could be accomplished at the box office. I think that those are both, you know, kind of equally important in the history of films that we're seeing, you know, play out now, as, you know, budgets for these movies have, you know, been bloated all the way up to $200-$500 million. So kind of changed the way that was going to work. But on the other hand, then, to that, as a piece of art, especially in 1977, I don't know that, you know, movie critics and things really understood what to think of Star Wars.
Yeah, they kind of just didn't understand, like, why are all these fans, like, I think this is literally where the term blockbuster comes from, because people would just be lined out of the theater, busting the blocks, you know? And they're like, we just don't understand why people are going to, like, this sci-fi fantasy fairy tale movie over and over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely, because it was this kind of swashbuckling adventure, but it was kind of strange, right? You had all the aliens and creatures and things, so yeah, people didn't really know what to make of it from that stance. But audiences, kids and adults both really loved it, and obviously racked up those box office dollars. 1975, ILM is formed to do the visual effects for the film Star Wars, so that's pretty interesting. And then the other interesting tidbit, I don't know if you knew this, Cassia, like I said, I think that I probably knew this, but maybe kind of forgotten about it. In 2013, Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, was dubbed in Navajo, making it the first big major motion picture to be dubbed in that language, so that is pretty awesome.
Wow, I had no idea. I hope that is available on Disney Plus.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't look. We'll have to do that and check in on that, because that's pretty neat. I think it was done at the... I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I think it was like the University of Arizona or Arizona State. You know, one of those higher education places down there. So that's pretty awesome. So that was neat to see. So that's kind of some tidbits about Star Wars. You know, there's thousands of podcasts and YouTube videos that go into the making of and all the behind the scenes stuff, and most people listening to this probably know a lot of that stuff, so I just wanted to kind of highlight some of the quick hits there about the film itself.
Yeah, and you know how, like, when we were covering the hero's journey of the prequel trilogy, we kind of read the Star Wars heresies, you know? Mm-hmm. This time around, we wanted to get kind of a little bit more of a current book, just something that maybe, like, we can be like, does this have something new to say, you know? So, like, I guess we don't have the heresies for the original trilogy, we just have maybe, like, the palette, you know, for the original trilogy. So we are reading the story palette book for the structure of Star Wars, the original trilogy, a scene-by-scene approach by Daniel N. Blair. And if anyone knows how to get a hold of the author, if they wish to appear on our little podcast and they want to talk about it, we're game, you know? And it'll be an easier read, I think, than the heresies.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that the heresies was really great in terms of kind of framing the prequel trilogy and what, you know, Lucas was trying to do and try to tell with those stories and characters and the way that kind of looked and felt. I think looking at Star Wars, the original trilogy, and kind of this story palette sort of thing makes sense, because in a lot of ways, you know, Star Wars, the original trilogy, could almost be its own, you know, heresies book, right? That it's very much this modern myth that people are drawing on and drawing inspiration from. So I think it'll be good to look at it as more of this kind of story palette, the way that it was put together and designed, as opposed to what inspirations it drew from. Because, you know, now, you know, 50 years on, it's...
We kind of know.
it's become, you know, it's become its own set of inspirations. So I think it'll be interesting kind of change of pace there as we get into that here a little bit down the line.
Yeah. And for our KOTOR people who are like, too long, didn't listen, did you want to go first and kind of be like, these are the links we saw with A New Hope in KOTOR?
Yeah, that's right. There are less kind of immediately direct comparisons, as at least I felt that I saw with the prequel trilogy, because that was kind of being made and released at the same time. But obviously you've got, it's very similar, kind of this straight-laced hero's journey kind of structure into Knights of the Old Republic. It feels very kind of Star Wars, Luke Skywalker in that sense. You've got the two bickering droids, that's good. You've got the Starforge, which is equal to the Death Star. You have Darth Malak, who is equal to Darth Vader. You have a Wookiee companion, and our beloved Ebon Hawk looks an awful lot like the Millennium Falcon. You can go into your list now. I'm sure there are a bunch, and obviously, you know, the people that were working on the game at BioWare, you know, were likely watching Star Wars and reading Star Wars and drawing all sorts of inspiration and parallels in there, but those were the ones that stuck out immediately to me. But what about you, Cassio? What did you come up with on your end?
I did kind of miss a couple from our Attack of the Clones episode, even though it was so long. But KOTOR 2 actually predicted Jango Fett's death, and I'm like, wow, Kreia is very precise. She could be an oracle at Delphi, and you may have mentioned this, but I forgot to mention it, like, beast control, you know? We see that in KOTOR 2, and it happened in Attack of the Clones. That was some nice synergy. And crate dragons, we see this in I was going to say Attack of the Clones too, but what I meant is A New Hope. We see the crate dragon skeleton, and we fought an actual living crate dragon in KOTOR, and that's been riffed on.
Do you think
on.
It's the same? Do you think it's the same crate dragon? Like, maybe
the
that is
same
the skeleton
exact
from
one.
I think so. KOTOR,
I don't think so.
149% canon now.
Yeah, let's just do that episode. Yeah, crate dragons, you see them everywhere. They crop up in The Mandalorian too, and in Dune.
That's right.
And then there is this quote that I love. It was actually in the introduction for Alex Kane's Knights of the Old Republic book. And Obi-Wan Kenobi says this line that I love. For over 1,000 generations, the Jedi Knights were the guardians of peace and justice in the Old Republic, before the Dark Times, before the Empire. And I think why I love that line, it's just so poetic, and like, how can you go wrong with like Alec Guinness, you know, saying anything? But that's kind of where the you first heard Old Republic, you know, in the very first Star Wars thing ever made, you know, and That line kind of inspired the comics, and the comics inspired the game, and its sequel, and even SWTOR and the Revan novel. But it's just a good line, and I think that also kind of inspired BioWare when they were making the first game. And My favorite companion in KOTOR 2, Goto, is kind of based on Princess Leia's, you know, like, torture droid.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, love, yeah. Goto.
Who doesn't, to be fair? Yeah, yeah, I love that you brought up that line, and that's a really good point, obviously, in the parallel to, you know, Knights of the Old Republic, the Old Republic. But, you know, since we're talking about Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, that line has become, you know, monumentally important in, you know, basically driving what we know of Star Wars today, right? You know, without that line, if that line gets cut, then, you know, anything else we got would have been completely different, right? You know, the prequels would have been different, Clone Wars,
yeah.
You know, these games, the way the expanded universe worked, the way that it's carrying forward, you know, even now into like the High Republic and stuff like that. So yeah, it's strange to think that one little, you know, I don't want to say throwaway line, but, you know, it didn't really mean much in the scope of you know, this film that we're talking about today, but, you know, had these huge rippling effects, you know, carrying on, you know, 50 years on, so.
Yeah, and, I mean, you mentioned the Ebon Hawk, but Ebon Hawk, Ebon means black, and then Hawk is, like, not as great as a falcon, and then Millennium means shining, so it's kind of like Ebon Hawk is not as good as the Millennium Falcon, even though they look pretty much similar. And that was the original name of the podcast, but then people are like, how do you spell that? And
why do you have, like, an Ethan Hawk podcast?
Yeah. Yeah, so we changed it to the Old Republic podcast, but Dantooine first got a mention in episode 4, and they kind of poke fun at that, you know, on the Leviathan. That's one of the options of dialogue, and you can be like, where is the Jedi Enclave? And you can be like, it's on Alderaan. which I thought was funny. And I only have like 5 more, so I'm trying to be quick, but there's a lot that inspired KOTOR, and the Starforge is basically like the Death Star. Although I kind of like, it's not just like, the Starforge is about like creating ships. It's creating warfare, not like just like a death laser, you know, for like the umpteenth time. So.
Right. Yeah. Like the little difference in the Starforge there, but it was basically a factory, I guess. I guess in theory, the Starforge could have been used for good, or it could have been used for bad. So.
Yeah. And then Jolee. We love Jolee. He's kind of a nice synthesis of like Obi-Wan Kenobi, Qui-Gon, and maybe even Yoda, I guess. I like that. Then that stupid damn turret game. I was so bad at it, but they're like, you're like Luke Skywalker in episode 4, and I'm like, I hated that. Yeah. I would die so much.
Same.
Yeah. And you know what I love most about Darth Malak?
There are many things to love about Darth Malak.
His jaw. They're kind of like, he has a jaw. He has a Darth Vader-y voice and a metallic jaw, you know? So that's kind of inspired by Darth Vader. And like, the more that Darth Malak gets fleshed out, I'm like, he's a nice, cool, tragic figure, you know? He just needs some good writing to flesh him out. So I'll save some of these last 3 for next time, I guess.
Oh, you had 3 more? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought
yeah.
You were...
Should I keep going, or
let's do it. We spent 2 hours talking about Attack of the Clones. We can spend some time.
We can do four hours for episode four.
With the best, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And then we see Yavin, which, or I guess we're kind of like in KOTOR, you're on a space station above Yavin, but in this one, you go to Yavin 4, which I believe they filmed that in Guatemala, I think, which is cool.
I believe that's true.
And, yeah. And then HK and T3 are kind of like, they're like, let's have a, you know, C-3PO and R2-D2 stand-in. And I'm going to commit a KOTOR heresy and be like, HK, he's cool, but he's just okay. Give me T3 any day. And I would be like, oh, I love him so much. He's like a faithful companion, like a dog, but a droid, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree.
Astrodroids forever, you know? Forever. And then last one, Dodona. There is a Dodona in KOTOR.
True.
She's a female, but she's leading the Republic. And in episode 4, we have a Dodona who is a man who is, you know, helping out the rebellion.
That's right, yeah. So when they're tying all these strings together for the Skywalkers, don't let that get you down, because we've got the lineage of Dodona going all the way back to the Old Republic days. And that's amazing. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
I mean, I think, like, it might even be in the Iliad and and the Aeneid and the Odyssey. I'll have to double check that. Maybe that's, like, just a lie, and I'm just thinking it's true, but I'll double check.
That's so. Right. If assuming that the James Mangold, like, Dawn, like, Birth of the Jedi story comes, please let that very first Force wielder be some sort of Dodonna. That would be that would be amazing.
That I would love that. But yeah, okay. So we're 20 minutes into this episode. So should we cover, like, you know, the story finally?
Let's get into the story. Let's get into Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, and the hero's journey within that story.
Okay. The writer's journey from Christopher Vogler, which is based on Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey. It starts off in the ordinary world. The hero is seen in their everyday life. So in this episode 4, Star Wars, A New Hope, who do you think the hero is?
This may come as a surprise to no one. The hero of Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, is R2-D2.
Yeah, that's true.
And that is only partially true. Obviously, Luke Skywalker is the real hero, but I totally did my hero's journey notes here from the perspective of R2-D2 being the hero. Aww. Of A New Hope.
That's okay.
So we're probably going to differ. I don't know. Who do you think the hero is here of our tale?
I obviously think it is, you know, Kleeg Lars. No, just kidding. It's Luke Skywalker for me.
Yeah, of course it is Luke Skywalker, but yeah, I totally did do mine from the perspective of R2-D2 being the hero here, and I think it actually is pretty compelling, I have to say. So yeah. let's get into these steps here. We're probably not going to rehash the whole film the same way that we did the prequel trilogy, because who has time for that? I mean, we do, of course, but you know, you've seen Star Wars Episode 4 a bunch of times, and obviously now Cassie and I are going at this a little bit different, because obviously I'm covering R2-D2, the real hero of the story. Cassia is covering Luke's story of whininess, where he's getting, you know, propped up on the shoulders of greatness, like R2-D2 is wanting to do. So let's get into this a little bit, Cassia. So the ordinary world, step one, the hero is seen in their everyday life. So for me, R2-D2, you've got the title crawl, we're on the Tantive IV, we are seeing R2-D2, you know, guarding C-3PO, you know, kind of caravanning him through this ship as Darth Vader and cronies have broken on board. They have captured the ship, and the stormtroopers are coming in. Blaster bolts are firing. We're avoiding them left and right, but this is just an ordinary day for R2-D2.
Yeah, the galaxy is in a state of civil war. You have the Empire versus Rebels. You have spies with weapons, and there's agents, like, just politics galore, you know. But John Williams, I'm so glad he won an Oscar for this. Like, it's the best intro music ever, inspired by Korn Gold, and John Williams is just a master, and just such a really good establishing shot. Like, it's up there with 3 for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it was kind of cinema changing. You get this opening shot of first you get the Tantive IV coming across, which is huge and breathtaking, and then you have the Star Destroyer, you know, chasing it down from behind, and that shot just goes on and on and on forever. It's hard to think of it, you know, now. You and I saw this when we were kids, obviously, on a TV screen. I'm guessing it was the first place that you saw it as well, but I can't even imagine what it would have been like in 1977 to have, you know, been going to movies and seeing things and seeing special effects and then going to see this, and just how, like, just, you know, instantly, you know, in that 30-second shot, like, the way movies were meant to look and how big they could be changed forever. It must have been something.
Yeah, if I could go back in time, they'd be like, do you want to, like, save any historical figures? And I'd be like, yeah, and, like, hide my plans for just seeing, you know, A New Hope in theaters, selfishly.
Did anyone need saving around Los Angeles in 1977? That's where I would like to.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean this in the best possible way, but like, I could watch this film in my sleep, and it's just so dreamlike and fairy tale like, and you kind of just see 3PO and R2, and it is cool that you kind of mention, like, you kind of see R2-D2 as the hero, because mm-hmm. one of the inspirations for this film was The Hidden Fortress, which I ended up buying on the 50% off Barnes & Noble Criterion sale. Nice. So I have that in the mail coming to me, but The Hidden Fortress was an inspiration, and that's, like, for a large chunk of the movie, you kind of see, like, C-3PO and R2-D2 kind of being the main characters.
Yeah, that's right. They're meant to be kind of these storytelling characters throughout. So obviously, you know, bringing in a little bit of a comedic relief, being something to identify with as the audience out there, which, you know, being droids, you know, it's a little bit crazy, you know, if you think about, you know, what this would have been like in 1977, obviously, you know, we're used to it now, but a little bit of a wacky way to do that there. But yeah, definitely these storytellers that are going to kind of haphazardly weave their way throughout, you know, obviously this film, but the entirety of the saga. We have C-3PO and R2-D2 are, you know, the only characters that get to be in all nine of the films. So
yeah. And I mean, isn't that kind of like a motif of Star Wars, is like, supposedly after all the characters die, like C-3PO and R2-D2 survived and came to our galaxy and told the story of the Star Wars, but maybe that would melt too many minds, so yeah. I don't know.
Yeah,
but
that's right. Yeah, I think yeah, because there was like the Christmas and the Stars and stuff like that, which I think kind of like hinted at that. But yeah, C-3PO was supposed to be like the storyteller, yeah, that came to our galaxy to tell us a story, and that's pretty wild.
Yeah, almost like midichlorians, so like, maybe we'll just keep it, you know, a new hope, you know. We see Darth Vader, he bad, he encased in black armor, he bad, he imperial. I don't know why I was kind of dooming that bit, but it happened. And then we see Princess Leia, who has buns in her hair and sometimes has a British accent and sometimes does not. But she's played by the incredibly talented, incredibly hilarious, incredibly badass Carrie Fisher.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. We're introduced straight away to our villain, Darth Vader, coming through. Got the little theme for Darth Vader going there. You mentioned kind of the scores. It's coming in, you know, it's sweeping, and then it changes the tone when that door opens up and he comes out. We see Princess Leia, but not before she has made the call to adventure. So step two, I'm going to go ahead and run through this because we're not going to get to yours for another minute or two, I don't think. So step two, the call to adventure, the initiating incident of the story. So here for R2-D2, the call to adventure is getting this mission from the princess, right? He's sent to go deliver Obi-Wan and these Death Star plans back to the Rebel Alliance. So that's kind of the mission that he's called to. So really, to get this thing kicked off, you know, obviously Darth Vader and his troops are taking over the ship when taking Princess Leia as a hostage in this situation. So that is really the propelling kind of event that is getting R2-D2 going on this mission, right? Probably could have had the Death Star plans in him the whole time, but really the initiating event is Darth Vader coming in, taking over the ship, taking Princess Leia as hostage, and he is sent off on his way in this escape pod down to Tatooine to deliver Obi-Wan and the Death Star plans.
Whoa! Okay. Wow, like, we're just on different, like, you know, timelines, but that's okay. So you can just, we'll just get to where I am soon.
That's right. We are getting to you very soon, because what happens, right? C-3PO and R2-D2, they make their way into the escape pod. They are shot down to Tatooine. You know, the Star Destroyer says, what is that? Oh, it's empty. Don't shoot at it. That's a big, big plot hole right there for me. This is the Empire. They're just going to shoot it down for fun. They don't care. Just shoot whatever. But that's okay. They let it go. It gets down to the surface of Tatooine, and our droids are there to kind of go their separate ways, only to be reunited in front of the homestead of Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, which I think is probably going to pick up into your step one, The Ordinary World.
Yeah. Praise be to Marcia Lucas, who saved the edit of Star Wars. Like, I don't think Star Wars would have worked without her editing, because originally the movie started off with Luke kind of just, like, wearing a poncho, seeing the spaceship battle from his house, and just talking to friends, hanging out. Like, it was kind of like American Graffiti on Tatooine. And then, like, all this time later, you see, like, Darth Vader, Princess Leia, and the droids, and she's like, let's just start with the action, and we'll just introduce Luke later when he's interesting, you know? So we get Luke's introduction, you know, like, looking for droids.
That's right. Yeah, they're out looking for droids. And if you do any research, like, on the hero's journey, that's kind of a common theme, right? Is you don't really get introduced to your hero until later on in the story, right? It's establishing kind of this world that the character is meant to live in, and then obviously is coming from, you know, very humble or meager or boring, I guess, life that they're living. And that's, you know, going to be what, you know, prompts them to adventure. Is, you know, R2-D2 and C-3PO are dropped off basically at the family farm. Uncle Owen buys these guys. I really like kind of the section when C-3PO and Uncle Owen are talking, right? And C-3PO is just going on and on about all the languages he speaks and stuff like that. There's this awesome cut where it cuts to R2-D2 and he, like, swivels his head and he's just looking at C-3PO. He's like, shut up, guy, you're blowing this. You're totally blowing up my spot right now. It's hilarious. I never really noticed it until I was just rewatching it to kind of go through these steps, but it was so funny. It cracked me up. I was like, he's totally because I was looking at it, you know, through R2-D2's eyes, right, to come up with this. I'm like, he's totally looking at him. He's like, dude, you're blowing up my spot. What are you doing? I thought that was great.
Yeah. So my step for the ordinary world was the Lars homestead and Tatooine life. And it's funny because in all my previous steps when we were covering the prequel trilogy, I included the opening crawl.
Mm-hmm.
But Luke is just like, that's not his life yet. It's just like, he's like, I wanted to go to the Tashi station to get power converters. So
that's right. Yeah, Luke's ordinary world is being sad and being a bit whiny about having to do chores, for sure. But yeah, obviously that is his ordinary world there, you know, living life on the farm, just doing stuff. Even getting C-3PO and R2-D2 is not anything beyond his ordinary world, right? That's just, you know, something they needed to get, like farmhands, basically, to droids to help out around the farm. So that's very much, you know, in his everyday life. So really, you're not going to get to Luke's call to adventure until R2 springs a trap on him. Which is, you know, I had kind of this in my, it's not really a refusal of the call, but I thought that it was funny, so I put it in there, and I'm going to get to my refusal of the call here in a bit, and then actually I think that our timelines are going to line up a little bit closer after that. But basically, here for me, R2-D2 has to totally trick Luke into going on this adventure to getting his restraining bolt taken off of him. So he's going to, I don't even think Luke had anything to do with it. R2-D2's like, I'm going to show him Princess Leia. That's going to get this kid to take off my restraining bolt, and then I can make a break for it. But that, obviously, the little blue Princess Leia, gotta be the call to adventure, right?
Yeah, for it's kind of one of them. I did consider, like, is this his call to adventure, but I kind of have it a little bit later. But
okay,
it's smart on R2 to be like, I mean, do you think R2 knew they were siblings?
Yeah, I'm gonna get to that.
Okay, but I'm like, it's a little awkward. Is he like, I don't know. It's like, what's going on in R2's mind? But like, I was kind of like, hopefully like Luke is just having platonic feelings here and like just wants to help this hologram out of the goodness of his heart. But help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope. Like,
right. It is exactly. kind of funny. Yeah, so see, R2 is thinking about it that way, right? He's like, I'm stuck here, I've got this restraining bolt on, this kid is whining about getting power converters, I need some help. Maybe he knows where Obi-Wan Kenobi is, I'll show him the intro to this video, maybe he'll be like, oh yeah, Obi-Wan Kenobi, I know him. He wasn't thinking that this guy's going to fall in love with his sister. That's not what he's thinking. That's not what he's thinking. He's a droid. He doesn't know about emotions like that. He was just using Luke to figure out where Obi-Wan Kenobi was, and it worked.
Mm-hmm. Like, good on R2. Like, he really may be the hero of the entire saga, honestly. I just want the R2-D2 cut of Star Wars, but yeah, he uses Luke to be like, take off my restraining bolt, and then like, Luke's like, oh, I'm not gonna go to the academy, and Lars and Brew, or Kleeg Lars, you know, Kleeg?
It's Owen Lars.
Oh my gosh. Some super fan is going to be like, well, actually, in the masterpiece Attack of the Clones, it is Kleeg Lars and Owen is the younger one. So sorry, Kleeg and Owen fans, I got them mixed up. But Owen and Beru are like, we don't want him to turn out like his father. Dun, 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 dun. And then Luke is like, binary sunset moment. And I think that's one of the greatest moments in, like, all of cinema, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely. You have the score is beautiful and epic there. You're seeing the sunset there. It looks absolutely unbelievable. I mean, you can go on Etsy right now and type in Tatooine Sunset, and you're going to get, like, 1,000 prints and pins and all sorts of things of that image because it's so iconic. And it's beautiful, and that's what R2 is rolling off into. But and that's kind of also going to be a little bit of part of this call to adventure too, right? Because Luke obviously knows about this Obi-Wan Kenobi, could be this old Ben Kenobi. He saw this this attractive princess that he's a little bit interested in, and now this droid that his uncle just bought has went off into the distance, and we're gonna have to go look for him.
Yeah, and he's like, maybe it's too dangerous at night. We'll get him in the morning. And he doesn't want to tell his uncle, which I'm kind of like, Luke is 19, but, like, maybe that's the correct choice, you know? So. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. It's not too dangerous for R2, who doesn't care. He just goes off into the night to carry on with his plan. But there are some refusals here for R2-D2. But so we've introduced Luke to the princess. We've sent him off to follow after R2-D2. He knows who Obi-Wan is. So what was your step two then? Cassie, are we getting to it? The call to adventure? The initiating incident of Luke Skywalker's story?
No. Luke's just so boring for so much of this movie. No, I'm just kidding. We're just not there yet. So
that is fair enough, because there's still some more adventures. You know, R2 is going through this whole section, and to me, this is all his refusal of the call, because, you know, we get there, we meet up with some Tusken Raiders. They're going to, they're going to knock Luke out. They're going to try to steal the speeder that he's driving. That's no good. But luckily, I guess, that we're going to meet old Ben Kenobi, Obi-Wan Kenobi. That's a name he's not heard in a long time, as it turns out. About 10 years, I guess, from the Kenobi show, we learned that. But that's who we're meeting next. We're meeting him. He's got a little bit of insight to who Luke Skywalker is, who his father is or was, and might be able to help with the situation regarding our blue princess hologram.
Yeah, Obi-Wan Kenobi, like, if Star Wars is like a fairy tale and Luke is kind of like someone who could be a knight but isn't a knight yet, kind of like a hidden King Arthur, I would say like Obi-Wan Kenobi is like a wizard like Merlin, you know? And kind of rewatching this after all the prequels and kind of like doing this podcast, I'm like, and especially after watching Kenobi, it's just like, I think like Ben Kenobi at this time, he's like, he's just getting right down to it, you know? He's like, oh, I fought in the Clone Wars, your father was a Jedi Knight with a lightsaber, he'd want you to have it. Like, he is just like, fast, getting to the point and being like, here's everything I know about your father. I think he's just like, it's time, you know? Mm-hmm. He is the Rafiki to Simba, you know?
Yeah, exactly, because, I mean, he's learning, you know, through kind of this projection that R2-D2 has brought him that basically something real bad must be happening to Princess Leia. It probably involves Darth Vader, and obviously he knows that piece of it, right? So, you know, the time is now for Luke to go, right? Obi-Wan has been tasked with making sure that this kid is safe and grows up to be able to learn the ways of the Jedi, and that time has come, and when that time has come, you can't dilly-dally around, right? You just gotta go into Mos Eisley and find yourself a ship. So yeah, there's not a lot of dawdling that Obi-Wan does, and, you know, in the movie, if you just watch it, you're like, oh, maybe, you know, he's like taking this kid under his wing and says, let's go, let's fly off this rock, you know, pretty quick. But yeah, in the hindsight of the stories we've gotten since, that makes a lot more sense. But, you know, Luke is a little bit hesitant to go with Obi-Wan, you know, despite wanting to leave, despite not loving his life on the farm. He's not quite ready to go.
Yeah. Okay, so you're going to be happy. My step two is here, but because you're talking about, like, under his wing and stuff, it just brought to mind, like, a funny image. It's like, what if, like, Luke is, like, a baby bird and, like, he is not ready, but, like, Ben Kenobi's like, you're ready because I say you are, and it's just like he just pushes him, you know? And
fair, yeah.
It's like, you're a Skywalker now, Luke! you will fly! But, yeah, this is the kind of, like, scholarly analysis we are bringing to this epic tome. But, so, my step two, the call to adventure, the initiating incident of the story, is you must learn the ways of the Force if you're to come with me to Alderaan. And then it's okay. Kind of followed immediately by my step three, refusal of the call. The hero experiences some hesitation to answer the call, and Luke is like, no, I have to help my aunt and uncle, you know, even though I want to go, I can't.
That's right, yeah, he cannot. He's got to go home, got to live life with Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, but unfortunately, that refusal is short-lived. When you get back to the Lars homestead, it's not good, not a good look. You left your post, Luke. That's bad. But I guess it's good on one hand, because if he would have been there, he would have been shot down too. That's what Obi-Wan tells him and says, now you have no choice but to go with me on our adventure.
Yeah, so what did you see for step four, meeting with the mentor? The hero gains the supplies, knowledge, and confidence needed to commence the adventure.
Yeah, so first let me run through my refusal of the call here, because I didn't highlight all the things that happened to R2-D2. So refusal of the call, the hero experiences some hesitation to answer the call. So obviously, you know, we get to Tatooine, we have our plan of attack, but what's our refusal? Now, R2 doesn't have a refusal of the call himself. He is straight up, he's going to go and do this mission because he is all business. He doesn't have a refusal, so his refusal is coming from without. So first off, C-3PO gives him bad directions. Way to go, C-3PO. There are Jawas, they capture us, put a restraining bolt on him. That's no good. We almost get passed over by Uncle Owen. Luckily, R5-D4 has a bad motivator. You can believe that R5 did that on purpose. You can believe that R2, you know, hijacked R5 and blew up his motivator back on the Sandcrawler. That's what I'm inclined to believe, but that's okay. Sand people show up, try to steal the ride that we're on. Obi-Wan pretending not to know me. What's up with that? get to the bar at Mos Eisley Cantina. We go in. The bartender says, "You don't serve my kind." I can't even go to the meeting with Han Solo. That's bad news for R2-D2. Gonna leave a bad Yelp review there. So basically, the refusal of the call for R2-D2 is all of Tatooine. All of Tatooine is the worst place for R2-D2. Refusal.
Yeah,
of the call.
It has sand, which is like literally bad for a droid. You know.
That's right. Absolutely. It is bad for a droid. So yeah, so I had like the entirety of Tatooine as the refusal of the call for R2-D2.
Did you have like the Imperial Senate being disbanded as part of the refusal from without?
I don't think so, because I don't, I guess probably in the scheme of the galaxy that could have been the case, and it might come into play when we're talking about the entirety of, you know, the Skywalker saga, but within the confines of this film, I don't think that it really played a role, at least in my bit here for R2-D2.
Yeah, I wrote Grand Moff Wilhelm Tarkin with hearts around it. He's not a good dude, but, like, he just, his cheekbones, even in CGI in Rogue One, I'm just like, would I want him to be my Star Wars husband from, like, a moral standpoint? No, but am I drawn to him for reasons I can't really convey because they're ineffable? Yes. I don't understand it, but yeah. So.
That's right. Grand Moff Tarkin shot a Death Star arrow right through my heart, for sure. So, yeah, absolutely. I like that. I like that. So meeting with the mentor, this one of all the steps for the hero's journey for R2-D2, this one was the trickiest one, I think, because it doesn't really have a lot of mentorship moments. So I put C-3PO and R2-D2 kind of hiding in that closet outside of the Mos Eisley Cantina, where, you know, the stormtroopers are all at. C-3PO, you know, gets to hide in there. I think that is kind of good, important, because that's going to be something that happens again on the Death Star. And then obviously, you know, kind of playing it cool, right? R2-D2 could totally go. He could take out all of those stormtroopers. We saw him do it 1,000 times with the battle droids. He could get rid of those guys, no problem. But he learns this lesson from C-3PO, is sometimes you just got to hide and play it cool. That's what's going to happen in Return of the Jedi when we're serving drinks, holding Luke's lightsaber. So that was pretty good. That was pretty good mentor moment, C-3PO. I'm also going to say that Han Solo is kind of like a mentor to R2-D2. Very inclined to shoot first, very much like R2-D2 is, but he has kind of the tools and the knowledge and this confidence that we need to gain, right? We need a tool to get off of Tatooine to get to the Rebel Alliance. So we're getting that in the Millennium Falcon. He's got kind of this confidence and the knowledge on how to get us there, because, you know, R2 is pretty self-sufficient, but doesn't have a ship to fly, but Han Solo does. So I think that's kind of also a very light mentor role there for him as well. But I think you're kind of at the same place with me, more or less, right now. So what about you, Cassia, meeting with the mentor? What's Luke getting up to? What is he learning? And who's he learning it from?
So I actually, for the first time in my Hero's Journey podcasting days, I'm going back in time. Meeting with the mentor. Obi-Wan giving Luke his father's saber is... I was kind of like, he's literally getting a sword, you know, it's like Excalibur, you know? That's what I kind of saw it as.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. That is definitely the kind of supply sort of aspect there. It's kind of this prize, kind of this thing that you're going to need to, you know, send you on your path, right? We don't really see Luke wield this lightsaber within this first... story too much. I mean, we see him with the training droid, but he's not really using it as kind of a weapon. So it's really more of a symbol, I guess, for Luke.
Yeah. I think, like, Luke is just kind of he wants to figure out where he comes from, and he just is kind of, like, looking for anything about his father, you know? And it's like, I kind of saw that as, like, here's your father's saber, you know? And Obi-Wan is probably lying yet again. And it's like, he'd want you to have this, you know? Because I totally am not lying. But, yeah, it's a beautiful moment. Like, here's King Arthur getting Excalibur. Here is Theseus meeting his father, you know, proving himself worthy, you know? So I was like, oh, I like that moment. But, yeah. And then kind of like... in the background of the galaxy, you know, Princess Leia is tortured by Goto, you know? Goto's still hanging around after the eons.
So wait. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but your Star Wars husband is Grand Moff Tarkin, and your KOTOR 2 companion is Goto, torturing poor Princess Leia. I think that says an awful lot about you, Cassia, I have to say.
I don't want to be an Imperial, but I didn't choose Goto. Goto was, like, thrust upon me. So, yeah, and unfortunately we see stormtroopers got to the Jawas and the Larses, you know, and I don't know, like, if in this day and age, like, George Lucas, if he were making Star Wars now, it's like, why did you name them stormtroopers after, you know, like, that's literally what Nazis were called in, mm-hmm. you know, World War II. And it's like a merchandise thing now. It you know, like, yeah, it's all the things.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's, I don't know, it's strange to think about. We actually recorded, you probably remember the episode number of it, I don't, or we could look it up, but the politics of KOTOR and Star Wars, which kind of digs into that a little bit. See, there you go, 109, go listen to that. That was an interesting conversation, and, you know, certainly there's tons of stuff about that, and Lucas, you know, spoke, you know, kind of at length in interviews and stuff like that, and behind the scenes material about, you know, kind of the political and real world influences on why he made the decisions that he made. So definitely search some of that out, because it's pretty interesting, I think.
Yeah. We condemn Nazis and fascism and empires and stormtroopers that are, you know, Nazis. And yes. I forgot to do that in episode 10 about Sith troopers. So to those people that were worried, yeah, we're not for that. So, yeah. A graceful transition. We got to see a Jedi mind trick, you know, and that's kind of like, I guess, another meeting with the mentor moment, you know, like Luke is learning, like, what's possible. Obi-Wan, I think Obi-Wan does realize, like, he doesn't have all the time, I was going to say on Earth, but I guess, like, in the galaxy. So I think he's just trying to impart as much as he can.
Yeah, it's almost less about Obi-Wan teaching Luke these lessons as it is as, like, piquing the interest of Luke, right? It's Obi-Wan obviously knows, or maybe he doesn't know exactly, but he probably has some sort of idea that he's not going to really be able to be, like, this, you know, Jedi master to Luke, right? But he needs to get him on the hook for wanting to be a Jedi, right? That's kind of his job now at this moment. Say, I gotta get this kid interested in living this life. He's quote-unquote our only hope, our last hope, so we need him to kind of buy into this thing.
Yeah. And according to, like, Disney Plus Star Wars, there is only one bar in Mos Eisley. And kind of like when you have Obi-Wan and the crew looking over Mos Eisley, and Obi-Wan is like, you'll never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. That's what I kind of saw as crossing the first threshold, was Luke going to Mos Eisley, because I guess he's like, I only live in the suburbs, you know, like I don't go there.
Yeah, for sure. That is, that's definitely, you know, quite literally a threshold that Luke is crossing into that bar, right? He is leaving behind kind of his common world, right? And going off onto the adventure then, and stepping into this place that is, you know, so far beyond, like, what his normal element would be. So, yeah, definitely I see that as kind of crossing that first threshold. For me, I saw the crossing of the first threshold, the hero commits wholeheartedly to the adventure for R2-D2. Now we've got the Death Star plans, we've got Obi-Wan Kenobi onto the Millennium Falcon, and we are taking off of Tatooine. Like I mentioned, Tatooine is kind of this whole you know, refusal of the call section for me. So actually, like, taking off and getting away from the stormtroopers that are shooting at us as we're taking off, that to me is R2-D2 crossing the threshold into the adventure.
Yeah, so I guess we ended Act 1. We could go brew our caffeine of choice, or, you know, mix it with coconut creamer. We'll take a quick break, and we'll come right back, I guess, to the Mos Eisley Cantina.
Mos Eisley Spaceport. You will never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.
All right, so we are back. I have my Coke Zero Vanilla, with coconut creamer in tow. What do you have, Brian?
Yum. I have a strong cup of black French roast coffee, some caff. That's what I'm going. You know, most likely Cantina. That'll take a toll on anyone. So I gotta get a cup of coffee here to get some energy going to, you know, carry on with the adventure, and to go through all the stuff I've been having, you know, been going on in my own real world life out here. I've been pretty busy myself. But what about you? What have you been getting up to here? We're taking our little coffee caffeine break. What have you been, you know, watching anything good, reading anything good? What have you been up to?
I went on a vacation for the 4th of July. And so that was fun. Just kind of get some nice time to catch up on books because, you know, I'm me.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've been talking about Indiana Jones and Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, and I ended up seeing that, had fun there, and kind of when you're on vacation with a lot of people, you don't really have time to watch, like, lots of movies, but I did finish Patton. It's a good movie about probably not the greatest person. And watch some Disney cartoons, you know. But tonight with my friends, I'm watching Agora, which we covered on the podcast last year, which I loved. And I also have plans to watch Whale Rider, you know. And I totally thought I was going to talk about another book, but I actually went to an annual 4th of July sale at a library that was near where I went on vacation, and I ended up buying a set of 12 books.
Oh, wow.
Nations of the World, Grotta's Greece, and for some reason Volume 11 was missing, which I'm sad about, but I was kind of just like, I'd already bought them and was just perusing them back at the hotel. And Volume 3, I'll just read this. It said, "This book first cut on October 29th, 1940 by Rosalind Keating Schaefer for her daughter Rosalind Jane, the date of Hitler's invasion of Greece. When German has given us these immortal volumes on the glories of Greece, another destroys Greece," and like that literally like took my breath away when I read it, and I was just like, I've been to lots of World War II and, you know, like Holocaust museums, but everything's kind of like separate, you're kind of separated with glass, but here is just holding something in my hands, and I think it's like the most tangible connection I've had to anything like relating to World War II. And because like Indiana Jones and World War II, and you'd recommended like the U.S. and the Holocaust to me, which I've been watching with my family, you know, and I watched the Errol Flynn film about rebels fighting back in Norway. I was just kind of like, it just got me thinking a lot about how, you know, some people want to save history and learn from it, and some people want to destroy it, you know? And I was kind of blown away. Something I got for literally, like, it was $2 per book getting the set, so I really got it for not as much as it's probably worth, but I was just amazed, and I'm just like, Hitler, you know, was trying to destroy Europe at one point, and the Ms. Schaefer, who wrote that in the book. Grotta, I believe, is actually English, but maybe you could say, like, one European wants to save Europe, or kind of talk about it, and one European wanted to destroy it. And technically, I think, like, the invasion started the day before, but, like, this is, you know, like, 1940 when she wrote it, you know, like, they didn't have 24-hour news to be like, actually, it was this day. But,
right, yeah.
Yeah, then I ended up Googling Rosalind Schaefer and figured out, like, she was a writer. She wrote a book called The Finger Man that was adapted into a 1933 film. I believe it was, I think it had James Cagney in it, which, yeah, 1933 film, Lady Killer, which starred James Cagney and Mae Clark, and she was someone who was a columnist and feature writer for the New York Daily News, the Chicago Tribune, and Associated Press, and worked in the publicity departments for Columbia, RKO, Paramount, 20th Century Fox, and she helped get some of the historical data, which was used in the 1939 film Jesse James. And with Luella Parsons, she helped found the Hollywood Women's Press Club, which sadly I think is defunct. I think it was last held in 2001, but she was also like the national vice president for the Muscular Dystrophy Association. So it's like, because I stumbled on this book by chance, like, it caused me to think about World War II and, like, just kind of, like, history, like, saving it or destroying it, and, like, figuring out about this woman's, like, legacy, which I think, like, she probably didn't get credit for a lot more of things, you know, like, that she probably helped with, you know, but I don't know if there's a moral to that, but it was just amazing to me to, like, kind of handle that in my hands.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's amazing to find something like that, and you had posted some pictures of it up on the Discord server, so I got a chance to see it. That is really cool. It's amazing, you know, to hold a piece of, you know, history like that, and, you know, especially from a time in the world, you know, like World War II, you know, which is, you know, as crazy a time as there was, and, you know, it's to find, you know, artifacts and stories from that period is getting harder and harder to do, right, as that gets further and further into the history. So it's neat to have, you know, stumbled upon something like that. That is really cool, very, very awesome, and that's really neat that you found that. So very cool, and then it, you know, propelled you to go on and learn more about who this person was and stuff like that. That's really neat. So I have... oh, I was going to say, so I have not been up to anything quite as monumental as that, for sure, but I have been keeping pretty busy. I had some family in town, but, you know, still making my way out to the theater. There's been a lot of releases coming out. There's a lot more releases coming out, so I'm going to be at the theater a lot. So we'd done Indiana Jones, so I was watching those at home, getting ready for Dial of Destiny, and I've been out to see that at the theater. I've also been out to see Asteroid City, saw The Flash, I saw No Hard Feelings at the movie theater. We've got Mission Impossible is coming out next week as of recording this, so I'll be making my way out to see that. So I've been spending a lot of time at the theater, not watching too much television wise. You know, I kind of finished, I think when we recorded last time, I think I'd probably kind of caught up on where I was on my TV watching, but I did finally finish a book. I finished Cataclysm, which is one of the High Republic books in this current wave, by Lydia Kang. That was pretty good. I finished that up here just a couple of days ago, so that was pretty fun. I really like the High Republic stories. That one just took me a little bit longer to get through. I hadn't been listening through that quite as quickly as I had some of the other ones, but now I'm finished with that. I'm going to be looking for my next read here to get started on pretty soon, and, you know, just watching Star Wars episode 4, A New Hope, to get ready for this, which is always a good time. I mean, it's definitely the Star Wars film I've seen the most, and it's the one that I know the best, but, you know, you still have to, you know, I have to watch Star Wars episode 4, A New Hope, to get ready for the podcast, you know. It's one of those things. So I did that too. On the night of 4th of July, my parents were in town, so I watched it. It was just like being a kid again, right? It was something I did 100 times with them, right? Sitting on the floor watching the VHS copy of A New Hope from the library. So it was very much just like that. So, yeah, that's what I've been up to. And I don't know, anything else to update us on, or should we head back into our adventure?
There's no droid kind here welcomed. So maybe to stand with R2-D2 and C-3PO, and I guess they're also against coconut creamer here, we can continue on our journey.
Hey, we don't serve their kind here.
What?
You're a droid. They'll have to wait outside. We don't want them here.
Let's wait out by the speeder. We don't want any trouble.
I heartily agree with you, sir.
Yeah, I don't think they had any coconut creamer at the Mos Eisley Cantina. Why would you go to the Mos Eisley Cantina? Should have went to Jabba's Palace and caught Max Rebo playing. Come on, what are you doing?
Someday we'll get more Max Rebo, but yeah, that sounds good.
All right, so we have crossed our thirst threshold into our adventure. Yours was Mos Eisley, mine was leaving Mos Eisley, which brings us to our next step, tests allies and enemies. The hero explores the special world, faces trials, and makes friends and enemies. So my kind of step six here is taking place on the Millennium Falcon, more or less, right? We meet Chewbacca. Chewbacca is pretty cool. I need some Jarek lessons. That's okay. R2's best friend Han Solo is here, flying the Millennium Falcon. Luke is over there whining. Obi-Wan is still pretending not to know me. C-3PO can understand me, so I can talk to him, so that's good. But, you know, we had some enemies, though, right? Stormtroopers were trying to shoot us as we were leaving. That's no great. TIE fighters just flew over my head. I know that those are bad news. I've seen those before. I know those. And it looks like we're about to get caught in a tracker beam. So, for me, Tess, allies, and enemies is on board the Millennium Falcon, basically from Mos Eisley to the Death Star. Well, what about you, Cassio? We are in the Mos Eisley Cantina. Is this where you're starting your step six within the cantina, or what do you think?
Yeah, so mine, I kind of saw the special world as it had two faces. Kind of like the Imperial Evil special world is the Death Star, and then the good light side of the Force is the Force. So my test allies and enemies is like getting off of Tatooine, turret training, and in my notes I put that damn remote, because I'm kind of sick of seeing it. Like, I think we've seen it in some of the Disney Plus shows and like every movie in the sequel trilogy. It's just, if I could do one thing in Star Wars, it's probably like just go there, destroy that remote so it can never be referenced again.
So no one can ever learn again? You'd destroy an,
like, against learning,
object of learning? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so turret training, we see that.
You'd give it to Tarkin.
Yeah. Here's the object of my affection. But, yeah, and then there's no Alderaan. They find the princess, and then Obi-Wan and Vader can sense each other, you know, after the Kenobi series, and then they have to shoot a wall and go into wherever it is, and it's a trash compactor.
Okay, so that was all your step six, test allies and enemies, is all the way up through to the trash compactor then, or?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Good job, Luke, there, finding your way into some trash compactor. I say my approach to the Inmost Cave, the hero nears the center of the story and the special world. I say that the Death Star is the innermost cave, and quite literally we're taking an approach to it because we're caught in a tracker beam and it is sucking us right in there. You know, R2-D2, he gets off of the Millennium Falcon. He is there. He is rolling around. He plugs into the console and he says, "Wait a minute. I know what this is. I have the blueprints for this place. Score. That's great. I don't really like it here. I might blow it up later. That's good. But also, I think in this section, it's very telling. Cassia, this is very telling. So basically, R2-D2 is the hero of the story. I've said it, I believe it to be true. But when Luke opens the door to Princess Leia's little cell, she's like, you're short for a stormtrooper, aren't you? And he's like, oh, my uniform. I'm Luke Skywalker. I have your R2 unit. That is the most important thing to Princess Leia. More important than Obi-Wan Kenobi. Princess, I have your R2 unit. Boom. Verified, R2 is the hero of the story. So, most important part. But yeah, the Inmost Cave to me is the Death Star.
That is a good point. I think George Lucas was very economical writing this movie, this screenplay, because you kind of just have Tatooine, Death Star, Yavin 4, space battle. It was going to be hard enough, but like he didn't include like 9 other worlds, you know? And right. During Corona, I was part of many book groups, but I think one of my favorite listens, besides Dune, was listening to George Lucas, A Life by Brian J. Jones, and kind of just hearing the behind the scenes. There were a lot of happy accidents and some not so happy accidents, you know, like when they're filming this, but I kind of recommend that, but... It is just kind of interesting seeing, like, Star Wars as a... It's a little baby Star Wars. First Star Wars. Just kind of seeing, like, Tarkin is more in charge here, not Darth Vader. And I think if Episode 4 were, like, made today, like, because of the connection with Darth Vader, like, it would just be Darth Vader running the show, you know?
Right.
So that's interesting, and... Because we're a KOTOR podcast, Princess Leia kind of basically takes over her rescue, and I love her for that. And it's kind of like, you're not rescuing me good enough, well enough. It's kind of like Bastila. It's like, you guys are going to get the group a C or an F, and I'm just going to take over this group project, so deal with that. So I thought that was funny.
Yeah, pretty much, right? Revan and Karth were like, all right, well, you do all the work, Bastila, that's fine. That's fine with us. But yeah, she totally takes over, and it is pretty awesome, right? She, right from the jump, right? She doesn't take any guff from Luke, from Han, from Chewie, and yeah, it's pretty great. So yeah, I love to see that. So that is kind of your approach to the Inmost Cave then. You know, we've rescued Princess Leia, that is good. Gone into the trash compactor, that is bad. So the Inmost Cave to you is the trash compactor, which is what I have as my ordeal. So the ordeal, the hero faces the greatest challenge yet and experiences death and rebirth. So for me, for R2-D2, this is kind of twofold, right? So I see the trash compactor as an ordeal, right? Because you have Luke in there, you have Chewbacca in there, you have Princess Leia in there, but most importantly to R2-D2 is you have Han Solo in there. Now Han Solo is the one that can fly this Millennium Falcon, get R2-D2 out of there, and get, you know, the plans to the Rebel Alliance. So in terms of R2-D2's mission, goal, objective, that is about to die in the trash compactor. So I see that as a moment of death for R2-D2. Nearly died. You know, C-3PO says that they're fine. So that's all good there. Another one is more of a metaphorical, kind of a lie, kind of a death, kind of a thing. Again, we're hiding in a closet, right? C-3PO and R2-D2 from the stormtroopers that are coming in to that little control center, and they're in there. They come out, and C-3PO says that, you know, R2-D2's circuits are overrun, right? So basically lying about his death, faking R2-D2's own death so they can get out away from the stormtroopers. So that is kind of a death and rebirth in the form of a lie, but that's okay. Also, we actually do have an actual death. Obi-Wan died, so that's bad. But we do still have the Death Star plans, so, you know, at least one part of the mission we've been sent on can be fine.
Yeah, you're very poetic, and it's like, and the Death Star literally is kind of like a deadly cave because it causes death on a grand total scale. And I'm like, for me, the approach to the Innermost Cave, it's like the Dianaga, the gross monster thing, and the walls caving in. But I'm going to try to save this and be poetic and stuff. Like, so they go down the garbage chute. There's like a Dianaga. I don't know about the spelling, but I'm like, that's weird. You could even say it's like a baptism moment that Luke Skywalker is underwater and you're like, is he dead? And it's like, no, he's alive because he surfaces and kills the monster. And then they're saved by R2, who is kind of like a god in the machine, you know? Saved from the crushing walls by the droids, which reminded me of Scylla and Charybdis from Greek mythology. And yeah, so I'm just looking at my notes. You can probably hear me with paper right now. That's just part of the experience. But the ordeal for me is Obi-Wan sacrifices himself. And then the reward. Have you gotten to the reward?
My reward is very close in coming. So
should I proceed go ahead forward?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead with yours. Yep. We'll see if they line up.
Looking over my notes. Okay, there's a helmet clunk, you know, which is referenced in episode 2. Stormtroopers just be doing that, like Django.
That's right.
And kind of like looking at this, I'm like, episode 4 is way less intricate of a plot than 1 and 2. I loved it. And then the bridge leap happened for luck, and it just brought to mind the Lego Summer Vacation, which might even be better than that moment in episode 4. But we get to see Darth Vader versus Obi-Wan Kenobi, which is a great moment. Just two old adversaries kind of facing off, and Obi-Wan sacrifices himself. Like, Darth Vader doesn't win there, you know? He just has to kind of, like, kill the shadows of the past, you know? But then Luke kind of hears Alec Guinness saying, "Run, Luke, run!" Which, for the reward, the hero experiences the consequences of surviving death. I kind of saw the reward as Luke can hear Obi-Wan, and the rebels have the plans.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely kind of the reward, is what I would see it for Luke too, right? The reward is that I guess he's gaining some insight to the Force through Obi-Wan's sacrifice there, and then obviously getting the plans back. So for me, I said that the reward, the hero experiences the consequences for surviving death. And remember, I said that kind of the external death for RTD2 was the kind of the mission that he was on, right? So if Han Solo dies in that trash compactor, he can never fulfill his mission, more or less, basically. So for my reward for R2-D2 was that they get out of there, they escape the Death Star. I actually wrote a lot of this in first-person perspective from R2-D2 as they're leaving. So he looks over and he says, "Was that Anakin? Whatever, time to go." And I like that a lot. I thought that was pretty funny. You know, we got the princess back. That's good. That's a reward. Obi-Wan died. That's bad. That is not a reward, but it's a reward for Luke, so that's good. Luke is taking this real hard. And I also have in my notes here, should R2-D2 tell them that their brother and sister, R2-D2 was there for that, remember? Obi-Wan pretended not to know R2, so I guess that's the game that they are playing. But yeah, for me, the reward is getting out of the Death Star, getting back on track to fulfill our mission of turning in the Jedi plans, which is part of my road back. The hero returns to the ordinary world or continues to an ultimate destination. So on our way then to Yavin, right? We're back to doing our astromech duties for R2-D2, right? Putting out fires on the Millennium Falcon, getting there, uploading the Death Star plans. That's great. R2 is, like I said, an astromech droid, so he's getting stuck into an X-Wing with Luke. I put in my notes here, apparently Luke says that he can do this in his sleep, so I don't know why R2 has to go with him. And then this Rebel Alliance guy, R2 is getting put into the X-Wing, and he's like, this droid is pretty beat up. Do you want a different one? And R2's got to be like, "Who are you, guy? Tell me what? I'm beat up. Get out. You know? Get out of here. Get out of here. I'm a hero. I brought the Death Star plans. Get out of my face." So that is my road back then, getting back to kind of the regular world of astromeching for R2-D2.
Yeah, I mean, R2-D2 could be like, "I was there when the rebellion was written." You know, like. I just wanted to add, like, Star Wars was written by a man. I think there's literally, like, Princess Leia and Beru, and those are the two women you get to really see have lines in A New Hope, but literally, right. Princess Leia comforts Luke, who lost, let me check my notes, Ben, that she knows about when she, like, lost everybody because, like, Alderaan is no more, but she's like, wow, that must have been really hard for you to lose a man who was kind of like a weirdo that you knew for a few hours, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Mark Hamill once in an interview said something about how was Luke Skywalker ever really supposed to find love, because there were only like three women in the entire galaxy and he was related to like two of them.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe there's like, we're not sponsored by My23, whatever that's called. I forget.
No, 23andMe.
Is that like half of like a chromosome genetic DNA thing? I don't know. Do we know science? Know. No, we just know Star Wars. But what if that existed, you know, in Star Wars? And it's like, your midichlorian count is zero. And it's like, if Luke could have been like, you and Leia are sisters. And it's like, how did that happen? Ben should have told him. Maybe it's because he didn't really date as a Jedi. But I think he should have like been like, don't have a crush on Leia because I think that Han called dibs or something. I don't know. But
dibs. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So this is our scholarly analysis of episode 4. It's so good, guys.
That's right. So let's see. I have my road back then. What is your road back? You mentioned, let's see, you said that your reward was Luke basically, becoming, getting the knowledge, I guess, of Obi-Wan dying, right? Was that your reward? Is that right?
Yeah, Luke can hear Obi-Wan, and the Rebels have the plans.
Okay, so what's your road back then? The hero returns to the ordinary world or continues to an ultimate destination?
I saw it as continuing to an ultimate destination. I kind of saw the road back kind of like as the final battle in the skies above Yavin 4.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense as the ultimate destination then for the Death Star. And that's kind of the same then, obviously, because Luke and R2-D2 are literally in the same ship going back to that ultimate destination. Which brings us to our, let's see, step 11. Oh, we went right through our baby break, didn't we?
Oh, wow. This happened once before in Attack of the Clones when we were just under, you know, like Anakin's spell of like love and stuff. But I think here That's right. we're just like, oh, like chromosomes.
Yeah, 50% of the time we miss the beverage break. So why don't we do this? We made our road back, right? We're in the X-Wing, ready to go. Luke and R2, they're still fueling up, but that's going to give us ample time to take a quick beverage break, I think.
Yeah, they're like, here's for your like little cup holder in your X-Wings. It takes a little bit of a journey to get to the Death Star, so let's have the best of, you know, because like, it's good to have alcohol, I think, even though I have a mocktail. I think you have a mocktail. They're like,
I do.
Let's have alcohol before we go try to destroy the Death Star, you know?
I feel like R2 would have definitely partook in that if that was the case. So yeah, let's take a quick break. We'll get our beverages going here, and then we'll be back to wrap up the triumphantness of the Rebel Alliance. Definitely not a word. Let's take a quick break.
Everything's under control. Situation normal.
What happened?
Had a slight weapons malfunction. But everything's perfectly all right now. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you?
Yeah. So, what are you drinking today, Brian?
All right. So for me, obviously, my hero here of the story is R2-D2, and I found a really fun, simple recipe, which is going to be perfect for the summertime. If it's hot, if you're having a party, you know, watching Star Wars, all that stuff, you can make up some of this R2-D2 punch. So this is pretty simple, pretty simple. So grab yourself a big pitcher or punch bowl, put 4 cups of blue raspberry Kool-Aid and a liter or so of Sprite. 7-Up, Starry, any kind of lemon-lime soda or like sparkling lemonade probably is going to be fine in there. Just give that a stir, and then what you're going to do is you're going to take a little scoop of some lime sherbet and put it into a glass and then top it off with your punch. So it's going to be like this lemony raspberry goodness, but it's going to be this crystal clear blue color, which is really fun and looks exactly like the dome of R2-D2. So sip and enjoy that all summer long. Get your Death Star plans back to the Rebel Alliance, because you are the true hero of the story.
Yeah. Maybe people listening would be like, they're not drunk, and it's like, no, we just, like, I guess, like, Star Wars itself is just intoxicating.
We're drunk on Star Wars, yeah.
Yeah, I just, so originally, I was like, I had this mocktail planned forever ago, because I was kind of re-watching some clips of Community. And for Troy's first drink, he was like, I want to have a 7 and 7. And I was like, oh my gosh, 7 and 7. Star Wars Episode 4 came out in 1977.
Ooh,
so
perfect.
Yeah. So I even got some like de-alcoholized. That's a hard word, but I think like whiskey and like kind of mixed it with Sprite. And I was like, I'll try this before we record our episode. And like, I was like, oh, took like half of a like kind of little, like just so like my tongue barely had any on. I was like, oh, that's disgusting. And like, that's probably just what like, you know, whiskey tastes like. Mm. But I'm like, literally can't do it. It tastes medicinal and like burnt. So like I'm just not feeling this. So I didn't end up having a mocktail 7 and 7. And I was like, what should I have? And I was like, oh, I can go to Arctic Circle and get a lime squeeze, because 7-Up, 1977, that's kind of like, you know, sort of related, because I need it to be. Because I can't think of anything else.
That's right.
And I was going to be like, what's the recipe for a Arctic Circle lime squeeze? But I couldn't find it. So I'll just read the Arctic Circle Lime Ricky copycat recipe for, you know, the Lime Ricky, which is probably more popular. 2-liter bottle of Sprite or 7-Up. 1 to 2 limes cut into wedges. Ice cubes, and then grape snow cone syrup. And if you just don't happen to have grape snow cone syrup, you can make it with 2 cups white sugar, 1 cup water, and then 1 package of grape Kool-Aid flavored drink mix.
Okay, that would be pretty good. I like the sound of that, actually. I really like using like grape syrup in both cocktails and mocktails, because it has a little bit of tannicness notes that you get like in like a wine, but you're getting it there from the grape juice. And yeah, that sounds pretty good. That sounds refreshing, and I like that.
Yeah, we just needed something, you know, refreshing for the summer. So yeah,
that's right. Absolutely. So so those are our beverages. Go ahead and check those out. We'll probably post them on our Discord. Check those out. Let us know if you have any other fun New Hope cocktails. But what we need to do now is we need to get back, because we blew right through. We're already in the midst of Act 3. I think the autopilot has just turned off. R2-D2 has alerted us, said that we are almost to the Death Star. You probably knew that because it's getting real big in the window. So buckle up, because we're about ready to wrap this up. So we're at the final destination, the ultimate destination, which brings us to Step 11, Cassia, the Resurrection. The hero experiences a final moment of death and rebirth, so they are pure when they re-enter the ordinary world. So what do you think? What is Luke Skywalker's resurrection step here?
Okay. For the resurrection, I put Luke is alone in the trench until Han and Chewie come along, and Han does a whole, like, yee-haw! And it's a great moment.
It is a great moment, absolutely. That is a good resurrection for Luke Skywalker. It's a bad resurrection for R2-D2. They couldn't have gotten there, like, 1 minute earlier. What the heck, Han Solo? I thought we were best friends. Terrible. So, resurrection for me, we've got R2-D2 in the X-Wing. You know, Luke calls for a stabilizer check. R2 does that. Calls for a power boost check. R2 does that. But then R2-D2 gets shot. Literally shot by Anakin. What the heck?
You freaking jerk. That's like the greatest betrayal in Star Wars, I think. Like, how many times was he saved by R2?
That's right. I says, in my notes, I says, WTF, R2 saved you so many times. Why would you shoot me? That's pretty bad. That's pretty bad. So that is literally a death here for R2-D2. But, you know, ultimately, Luke pulls the trigger for the missiles to go into the Death Star. But guess what? All of those signals are being run through R2-D2. R2-D2 gets credit for making that final hit. So, boom. Even though Luke turned the computer off, doesn't mean that the computer is not still running in the X-Wing. R2-D2 gets the job done, blows up the Death Star.
Yeah. And so I saw the return with the elixir as the Death Star was destroyed, and then medals for everyone. And I guess, like, the medal ceremony, if you think about it, like, no one says anything. It's just a silent scene with, like, John Williams music. Like, mm-hmm. If you really thought about it, like, was there a program? It's just, like, they smile at each other in turn, and it's just funny.
It is pretty funny. That is pretty funny. Yeah, so that's more or less what I have as my return with the elixir. The hero returns with something to improve the ordinary world. So R2-D2 is back to being an astromech droid for a Skywalker. Great. at least R2 has lived to fight another day and basically bring peace to the galaxy, because that's what R2 is all about. R2-D2 does not get a medal, which is pretty harsh. There are no droid rights here. We need to have a little bit of a protest there. Chewbacca is going to be an ally in this fight, I am pretty sure. But R2-D2 is nice and shiny at the end of the day. So that is the elixir. No metal, but does get polished up. So that's good. That is the end of the hero's journey tale of Star Wars Episode 4, New Hope. I hope that everyone enjoyed that. It was fun, I thought, going through and looking at it through the lens of R2-D2, which was something I was inclined to do, obviously, as a big fan of R2-D2 being my favorite character. But kind of the more I thought about doing it, I was like, this kind of makes sense. I think I could really pick out all of those steps within the film for it. And I thought that was pretty fun. So hopefully it didn't throw too much of a wrench in everyone's listening and into what you had for your hero's journey steps there, Cassia.
Oh, I think it's good to, like, have some different opinions, you know? Like, sometimes we cover the villain's hero's journey, you know? And sometimes, like, we're like, no, R2's the hero because he doesn't whine like a little baby. So
that's right.
Yeah,
absolutely. He's a champion for sure. So yeah, so that's more or less the hero's journey. Let's talk just a minute or two here before we wrap up. We're getting into Attack of the Clones territory here time wise but that's, yeah. okay Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope. You know, we talked about kind of our love of the prequels, but I really grew up watching, you know, the original trilogy as being, you know, a little bit older than you. This was really where I cut my Star Wars teeth, so to speak, on this film. But what about you, Cassia? What was your introduction to A New Hope like?
I was babysat at my aunt and uncle's, and I was like, what's Star Wars? And they're like, let's watch it. And I was like, I'm in love with it. Like, can we take it to our house so I can just watch it over and over and over again? I loved it so much. Like, we just didn't, like, go down to my aunt and uncle's as much, you know? And then I was talking to someone about it, and I was like, I love Star Wars. And they're like, have you seen 4 and 5? And I'm like, what's 4 and 5? And there's like, there's two more. And I'm like, can you just tell me the whole story, like, before I see them? So, like, I think, like, 5 and 6 were actually spoiled for me. But I still loved them when I finally saw them, you know? And then I was so obsessed with Star Wars, like, at the perfect time. like the new special editions came out on VHS. You know, I had the Golden Vader edition, and I think my parents knew that I loved the love story of Leia and Han so much, they got me the action figures of them, and I was like, cool, I love love. And just, I just kept on watching them over and over and over again. And then one day, I was at the movie theater with my mom, and I saw the Phantom Menace teaser trailer, and I'm like, they're making more of them! And I was so happy.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah, I remember watching this a ton when I was a kid. So if anyone out there is listening who doesn't know, Star Wars Episode 4 New Hope is my favorite Star Wars movie. It's my favorite movie in general, and I watched this a ton growing up. My mom worked at a dentist office that was just a block or two away from the big county library, so she would rent movies pretty frequently from there because you could check them out for free or like $1, I think, maybe kind of at the end for like new releases and stuff. But one of the things she would bring home pretty frequently was one of the Star Wars films. I have a brother who's 7 years older than me, so he would have been like right at like prime age when these came out. So he had a lot of the toys and stuff like that. And, you know, obviously they were bringing it home for him, and he liked Star Wars well enough. But really, you know, I was the one who kind of fell in love with it, you know, kind of obviously, if you're listening to this, kind of almost obsessively to a point for sure. But yeah, it's just always been a part of my life then in terms of something that I loved. And yeah, there's something that's just really special about New Hope for me. In terms of the Star Wars saga, and I don't really like to get into like rating the other Star Wars films and making, you know, my favorite lists and stuff like that, but this one is definitely extra special in terms of the Star Wars films. So it was really fun to go back and watch it, and to watch it in a different way than I ever have. You know, I've probably, you know, like you, Cassie, I'm sure, like everyone who's listening to this right now, have probably, you know, seen, you know, Episode 4 100 times, but it felt different watching it this time, you know, trying to look at it through a different lens, and that was really fun, I thought.
Yeah. In some ways, I'm like, did we, you know, like, contribute good scholarly analysis? I mean, I think yes.
Yes.
Definitely, but yes. Maybe other people did it a little bit better, but are you going to be entertained listening to this version where, like, Brian and Cassia are just literally hyper because they had 7-Up and like they're just so happy? Yes,
absolutely, yeah, for sure. It was very fun writing the notes here for R2-D2 from his perspective. I thought that was fun. Our drinks were really fun, so definitely go give those a try. And it's always fun going through and analyzing stuff in the hero's journey framework of the story. So definitely good. Definitely go check out Hero's Journey podcast, who were definitely ripping off on the way that we've structured these, but that's okay because that podcast is great. Go check it out. Go check out our episode. We had them on as guests on an episode where we did the same kind of treatment for Knights of the Old Republic. That's one of our best performing episodes. So go give that a listen.
Five.
It's like 129, is that right?
123.
So go 123. Go give that a listen. Go check them out, and stay tuned here because we're going to be getting into the Star Wars story palette, as we mentioned kind of at the top, and then our next Hero's Journey analysis is going to be on the darker second chapter of the original trilogy, Empire Strikes Back. So look for that in the not so distant future, probably. And thanks for tuning in to Star Wars Episode 4: A New Hope, Hero's Journey Perspective. Cassia, any closing thoughts here before we wrap up this tale, or we're going to take our medals and head on out of here?
May the Force be with you. Republic Podcast can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, as well as everywhere else that Anchor Podcasts are distributed. Subscriptions, reviews, and shares help us out.
And if you want to connect with the podcast on Twitter, we can be found at Old Republic Pod. And if you want to connect with me, I can be found on Instagram at @astro_droid_.
You can find us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/Old Republic Podcast. Our intro and outro themes were composed by Dennis S. Mowers at DennisSMowersMusic.com.
This episode of the Old Republic Podcast has been brought to you by Nikki Dog from Patreon.
May the Force be with you. We will be back soon. Bye for now.